Welcome to our weekly live stream recording of the M&A Zing, a podcast series devoted to acquisition entrepreneurs, search funds and holdco builders in the UK, EU and beyond. We discuss the topics and challenges that impact SMB succession M&A and explore the highs and lows of searching, acquiring, owning and operating small and medium-sized businesses. This week, we have a very exciting interview for you and something that's taken a maybe slightly different path. So I speak to lots of searchers all the time that are out for their sort of white whale. They want to see one big acquisition at the start. And I met Cal at our Serial Acquirer Symposium, and he took a slightly different route in, which I thought was very interesting and I'd like to share with you. So if you are looking to complete your first acquisition, especially, stick around for this rest of this episode, because I think you might pick up some interesting tips. So first off, Cal, thanks for joining me.
Awesome. Thanks, Alfie. Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I know that I sent you over a few other episodes and you joined us for the Serial Acquirer Symposium. How did you enjoy the event?
It was good. Yeah, the symposium was a good networking event. Met some, had some good conversations, met some good people, managed to pin down some of the venture capitalist guys as well and have a chat with them to see how they're going and kind of what their investment criteria was, as well as like the software that's coming out, like with you guys and the other gentleman that was there with his, fun search or whatever.
Joe with Dealflow Agent. Yeah, really interesting stuff. Yeah. Awesome.
I mean, AI is just crazy, but he's leveraging that pretty hard, as I imagine you guys are.
Yeah, and AI was a real sort of topic of the day. Piers Linney's talk at the start was super popular as well, the sort of AI sort of post-acquisition. I think that was really illuminating for a lot of people.
Yeah, for sure.
Before we dive too deep into your acquisition, because that's obviously what we really want to get into, let's learn a little bit about you. So, you know, what's your professional background, Cal, and how did that lead you into ETA?
Yeah, I'm an accountant by trade, originally from Australia, from Perth, trained there. Originally, I started BDO in international and corporate tax. Didn't really like that too much, so moved into insolvency. So I was doing liquidations, turnarounds, trying to sell businesses if we could save them. But generally that wasn't the case. It is with insolvencies. You're generally selling off bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was a really good experience in terms of getting into managing businesses. Cause if you think about an insolvency situation, when the practitioners come in, they're replacing the directors. So as a young, like 23-year-old, I was going in and with my managers, but a lot of time just they left me to it and to manage teams and kind of see what we could do in terms of turning places around.
That's interesting. Is that some real sort of boots on the ground experience from early on for you?
Yeah. So I did my chartered accountancy there, did some insolvency law qualifications as well, which aren't very too useful in the UK, but there you go. And moved over to London like 11 years ago now and just moved over to work for myself as an independent consultant, just as a kind of business analyst, primarily, which is a jack of all kind of trades type of role where I was essentially going into various companies, a lot of government work, fixing problems where you come in for a short period of work to cover someone or just look at an issue and then you unpick it and try and come up with what the recommendation and approach is to fix it. And then usually that rolls into the next problem and the next problem and the next thing. And that's kind of like what I've been doing consultancy-wise in the UK. And to be honest with you, still doing that while I've gone through this acquisition and I'm still working as a consultant because the acquisition isn't paying for the bills. So that'd be one of my tips is keep your job if you can.
That's a great piece of advice. I think there's lots of other people that end up in that same situation. And I think being prepared for that is a smart thing. I was going to say, you know, coming into this from that insolvency background, I think that's really interesting. It's some great experience because lots of people only start to come across those kinds of issues at the point of after of owning a business. You know, some people come into this having never bought a business before or really operated at that level. Some people have operated, but only at other businesses that perhaps haven't been through that. So you've seen firsthand, you know, the problems that cause businesses to go down the insolvency route and how to fix those. And you've been doing so for a long time. Do you think that puts you in a good sort of driving seat to be a great operator?
That's the thinking. Yeah. We'll see.
And so what was it that, you know, took you from that to ETA? What sparked your interest initially in acquiring a business?
So I've got another business as well, which is started 6 or 7 years ago with a few mates I was consulting with, a couple of Aussie mates as well that I moved over to London with. And we build houses in South London.
Oh, wow.
So we've been doing that for a little while, and just small sites, like just 1, 2, 3, 4 units. Nothing too huge. But just the lumpiness of that business, I was really just getting to me. Like, it's quite stressful, like when you've got hundreds of thousands of cash just leaves your bank account, and then you're waiting on the whims of the market to whether you're going to sell these houses or not, or what's going on with interest rates is a big, a huge impact on whether we're going to be making any money or not. So I started looking, I was just basically looking for ways to have some stable cash flow in that business, and just went down the YouTube rabbit hole, found a whole bunch of people, John Jay, Jeremy Harbour, watched a lot of their stuff, and then went into, started the search, really. Like, was convinced by it and was like, makes sense. I was like, okay, this looks like we can buy someone else's 10, 20 years plus business and plug that into my business. And that sounds lovely. That sounds beautiful. And then hopefully it's not operating too well, so I can grow it.
And you somewhere
else started off. Yeah. Yeah. To start off in the property, looking in like property sector.
Okay.
And got to the finish line on a whole bunch of on 3 deals in particular. And my mate, I've ended up in health, but my mate who's brought me into health, who's a radiologist, is my business partner. He's like, man, you just keep getting blueballed. You've been blueballed so many times. You got to come over to health. Let's take a look at it.
I mean, that's another interesting learning for anybody that is getting into this, because I speak to lots of people that get to that same point. I mean, I will start calling it blueballing, but I haven't to this point yet. But lots of people do get to that kind of almost sort of moment of completion of a deal, and it falls through. I mean, do you mind sharing what happened to some of those?
Yes, I think I'd be a self-funded searcher, and I think it's probably just the learning curve of being a self-funded searcher. Of every time I was getting further along or down like the acquisition stages, if you like,
mm-hmm.
I just kept, there was just something that would go wrong, and then it would either be, you reflect on it and go, I could have handled it differently and probably would have actually got a deal there, or I should have walked away from it, or whatever it was. There's, you can find an excuse to blame yourself. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it was just kind of like, the learning process. So I had the first one I got after 6 months, and it was a electrician, mm-hmm. and he's around St. Albans, and he was a good size, 1.1 turnover, had just put in some systems in the previous 12 months, which had enabled him to grow, had a good team around him. A lot of uncertainty around that I had around like how reliant the business was on it with him.
Okay.
But his whole thing was he just had enough. He's like, I want to move to Spain. My partner's moved to Spain. I'm behind. I need to get rid of this thing. I need to be out within 3 months.
Wow.
And I had booked my summer holiday to go to Greece, go sailing in Greece. Mm-hmm. And my wife wasn't going to let me get out of that or work while I was on the boat. Over that week, I had some finance terms that I had said to him that I was going to get in before I left and would send to him to think about over the week, and then we'd hopefully do a deal when I got back. During that week, I didn't get those terms in time, and then someone else he was speaking to did get terms to him, and he'd sold it during the week I was away. So I missed out, and it would have been a great one. Like,
wow.
In terms of like the numbers, it was a no money down deal. It was ticking a lot of the boxes. There was a lot of uncertainty still around door lights on him.
Sure.
That was the first one.
It sounds like a great business on paper, especially with the level of motivation from the seller. I hope sailing in Greece was worth it.
Yeah. Well, I'm still married, so I guess,
That's the more important thing here, actually. Yeah, it's not about the saving. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah.
Second one was in the Midlands, near Wales, West Midlands. And it was a pole planting business. So this business, pole planting is your power lines, how they're on like a wooden pole that's in the ground. So those poles, they degrade over time. Someone's got to come out and replace them. Happens every, depending where it is and like kind of the quality of how it's being planted, all this kind of stuff. But that happens like every 20 to 30 years or something like that. So this is one business had a big contract with the utilities provider in that area. and expanding actually. And this gentleman was in his 60s and his dad had started the business and he wanted to pass on to his son, but his son didn't want it. But his son wanted to work in the business. So it was great. That's like a nice story and great kind of scenario of how it was all coming together. What happened was I think it was a communication breakdown in terms of the deal I was putting forward and how much money he was going to get on day one.
Okay.
So this is another no money down deal. So I was going to basically, he's got all these trucks and all these JCBs, which how he runs the business, and they're kind of spread out or throughout the Midlands is where he's got his area, his patch that he does his pole planting. Mm-hmm. And, paid for the valuation to happen, told him what I thought I was going to pay him on day one and the rest was going to get deferred over 10 years. And plus he wanted to work as a consultant within the business and top up his income if he needed to. Do the valuation, kind of, we're a couple of months in and just starts to fall apart. And the reason it fell apart was because his wife didn't trust me and didn't want the deal because she was concerned that she wasn't going to be able to maintain the lifestyle and pull as much out of the businesses as what they were doing already. So that was a huge lesson. I was like, well, if you can't win the wife over, just give up. Because if she doesn't like you or she's not into it, you're in trouble.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think everybody does need to be on board. Do you think perhaps also the long terms had part of that because they have to trust you for 10 years, you know, to get that payout over that amount of time? Do you think maybe that factored into it at all?
Could have. I mean, I started off kind of from negotiating from day dot, kind of telling him in the first meeting was going like, yeah, well, this is how, you know, if this is kind of the structure I'm thinking about, like, this is how I think it's going to work. And just try and lean on the partnership kind of model, like want to keep you around, want to keep you employed, mm-hmm. want to basically work together to do a handover. It's less me buying it and more of us working together to get the deal across the line and get something that works for everyone. He was quite motivated. He had some injuries and was getting a bit sick and like was having difficulty walking around, had a hip replacement and the other one was going and just body was falling apart. So he was like, yeah, I think he wants someone to come in, but I think I could have got a deal there like without the wife. Like it felt like as soon as I wasn't in regular contact with him, he would just go off me. And when I went over there and was like, took her out for dinner and stuff like that, she was always a bit cold and kind of like, I don't know, I could just sense it wasn't in. And on the final call that I had with him, his accountant and his wife, to kind of go through it as like a last effort, she just basically took over the call and said, how can you expect us to live on what you're offering? How do you expect this to be? I'm not going to be able to maintain my lifestyle. I don't think this can't work for us. So she just basically, took over as the lead negotiator on her side.
That's so interesting. So it's a communications breakdown, but possibly between the seller and his wife rather than anything that you've done wrong there. Because if those were your terms from the start, then perhaps they weren't being adequately conveyed back at home.
Yeah. 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 Potentially.
That's frustrating. That's frustrating. And how did you transition from these kinds of companies? So you said that your friend was a radiographer. I mean, had you considered, you know, health at all before, or was this, you know, purely sort of driven by your relationship with your friend?
Yeah. So a mate from that I went to high school with, actually, he was doing a fellowship in Birmingham and he was just couch surfing at my place on weekends or where he had a bit of a holiday. And he was just telling me about what I was doing and I was only looking in construction property space. And he said, just to have a look at physios. And he's like, the Australian model of physiotherapy and integrated healthcare of in Oz, you typically go to a physio and a lot of the time you'd have a diagnostic service alongside it, or you'd have some other service that's in the same building that complements it. So you have an internal referral system. And like that's just not really around here.
No.
You don't see it. And so he's like, why don't we? He's like, look at for physios. He's like, I'll bring in the diagnostic service, which is high margin as well. And he's like, just take a look at some physios, see what you think, see, you know, if that kind of like stacks up with what you're looking at the moment. So I took a look and just comparing sectors, the increase in multiples and valuations goes up much faster in healthcare than it does in construction. And it kind of makes sense with healthcare. You kind of, it's not lumpy cash flow. It's very consistent cash flow. People pay before treatment. So the cash flow cycle is positive. Lots of customers, high demand. It's a good sector to be in versus the construction side where there's a lot of risk and people pay after and it's delayed and negative cash flow cycle. Yes.
Invoice terms in construction are an absolute nightmare. The red tape and the things, the boxes that need to be checked and waiting to be paid. And, you know, yeah, it is a long process. I can absolutely see that, you know, Physio would be a much cleaner transaction.
Yep. So, yeah, the physio side was looking good as a practice to start. And then, you know, with the value addition of the diagnostic service alongside, and then also researching into that, the wait times and everything, the NHS difficulties that are going on and how hard it is to get decent care and get, you know, actually even find out what's going on. It's crazy, the wait times at the moment. So it's a nice time, a perfect storm really, to kind of like enter into this space. And I think we've got a good model, operating model, which is basically being the objective of this first one, is to build out our case study, define our operating model, to kind of like get everything documented and wrapped up, our systems in place, and kind of get ready for how we would take this going forward.
Yeah, and this is what, you know, really interested me when we first spoke about this. I mean, obviously, I totally understand the issues of the way the physiotherapy and NHS in injury and musculoskeletal stuff is treated in the UK. I've had a raft of sports injuries myself that I won't regale on everyone with on here, but I've had a tough time with it. And I'm a big lover of the NHS. I think they do a great job, but they, you know, spend most of their time on sort of critical care. And I think some of this other stuff, we do fall behind. You know, I can totally see in Australia that you probably have a better system, much more kind of sports focused. And I guess that there is also a payment at point of service, if I'm right, as well. So maybe that fuels that a slightly different model there. So you're kind of bringing an entirely new model to the UK, and you're also potentially going to be working with the NHS, you said, or is that correct?
Yeah. That's the view. So, so I think our, like the model we're going for with integrated healthcare in a single location, you have the physios there, which is, we're trying to do primarily private. Physios don't typically get referrals in for NHS. It's kind of like a very, that's kind of already been done with like the large physiotherapy practices that are out there. Yeah. So that kind of generally keeping private, but then our diagnostic, which is starting off with ultrasound, and hopefully within a few years, we'll start getting MRIs and maybe x-rays and things as well. That diagnostic side, there's really big wait times in NHS, and I don't think they know, there's an opportunity to partner with them. So yeah, we're looking to, once we get certified with CQC, because we need that to enable the contract with local hospitals, then we'll be looking into, yeah, for sure, try and relieve some of that wait time and get some of that demand into our clinic, and work with NHS.
It's so interesting because I think that it's not only a great service, especially the people that will get to use your diagnostic tools, but also to everybody else in the area that does have those long waiting times. It's going to alleviate a bit of that kind of pressure on the NHS, who perhaps don't have the same systems in place. So I think that's super interesting. To go back to another point that you mentioned, your model, and you said that you're kind of testing it out. And again, that's another thing that made me want to get you on the podcast and share this with people. Because like I said, when we first spoke, you said that you had initially, you know, looked at going out and raising funding and maybe acquiring a slightly bigger business than you actually did in the end. And I think you actually went a little smaller, if I remember correctly. And you know, you've had to apply that model and get some learnings along the way in possibly a slightly less risky environment. And now you can take that learning and that model and apply that to, you know, maybe another acquisition down the line or potentially even a sort of larger physio or a group.
Yeah, for sure. So we went micro. It's so small for our first one. Like, we self-funded, just trying to think, okay, well, I know I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. I know there's going to be lots of issues. There's things I just don't even know about, which I know I'm going to balls up. So we went pretty small. So the business, the physio we got, was only doing 435 turnover in the last 12 months from we bought it. And, I made all the mistakes. My business partner is basically relying on me to make a good decision. And I tell you, I did everything wrong. I mean, I got like, I think I was a year and a half of searching after being, you know, with a bunch of deals that have fallen through. So I was getting very hungry for something just to get across the line. And this thing, I was like, okay, well, it's like I could do. I was like, my thinking was that if I make every wrong decision, I'm pretty sure, like, I can still cash flow this thing to eventually get it to a point where it's going to be able to turn around. And that's pretty much what happened. Like, it was reliant on the owner. He was a key income earner, which we're going through the process of kind of replacing him at the moment.
Okay.
The staff and culture, there was no culture. The staff have all changed because we've come in and we're trying to actually generate like a team working environment and change things a bit much, maybe.
Okay.
The financial reporting wasn't great, so I've had to tidy that up. No marketing whatsoever, no marketing or sales system, so I had to implement that. Unreliable booking software, so I've had to change the booking software. Just everything's changed.
Yeah, it sounds like every possible fire you could have to fight, you've had to fight with this business at some point.
Huge learning curve though, but it's been great. And then actually through this, I mean, we bought it in August last year, so we're almost a year in. And then in April, I did a little tuck-in acquisition as well. Bought the local chiropractor and tucked that into our clinic as well, which is
awesome.
Which was a massive, massive help to our cash flow, which is great. And now we're at the point, I think we're going to get to 12 months. We're basically going to have our playbook, if you like. You know, we're going to have everything kind of, we've been through everything that you could go through. We know what we need to do to solve it. And then we can hopefully go out and solve that for other people through like a equity, you know, consulting for equity model, or go in and just be able to identify things. You know, once you've been stung and gone through the actual process and lived it, you're well aware to make sure. I mean, I'm not going to forget to make standardize someone's salary, the owner, you know, if they're doing any work in the business whatsoever, like that, that's going to definitely stay with me for life now. Or, you know, just understanding the quality of earnings and going through the process of where's the money coming from? How are they paying for people to come in the door? What is the marketing sales process? Oh, it's the guy who's actually just calling up his buddies who he knows for 15 years who are GPs and consultants around the place, and that's how he does it. Okay, well, that's not ideal for me. But, the basics. I've got the basics down now for sure.
And do you think that from your experience in, you know, working in insolvency, you were maybe a little bit less daunted by these tasks because you've seen companies had to see a lot of change come in and teams turned over? And is that something that you perhaps maybe a little less scared of this than another operator might have been?
Potentially, yeah. I suppose being in distress situations. So I guess it's difficult, right? Because if you're the insolvency practitioner, you don't take on any liability. Sure. Whereas if you're the business owner and you take on the shares, from the point you take on those shares, you've got director duties. You are liable for the actions that you take from that point on. So you need to be pretty on it. I'd say like that. It's still daunting. I suppose the thing that made it more possible, kind of like livable, is the fact that it was just a small business. So it wasn't the end of the world if it failed. It wasn't the end of the world. I also got a loan that was only 20% PG. So I only got a loan for 100 grand to buy this business. 20% PG. So I'm on the hook for 20 grand. And that's obviously an all right chunk of money for some people, but like worst case scenario, everything just went to hell. I can kind of work that off over a few years, but I don't think it would even get to that point. There were assets in the business to be able to sell off and cover that.
Smart. And if you had gone down maybe a more traditional route and you'd purchased a business turning over, you know, a couple of million, then it would have been a slightly more daunting and maybe a different story.
Different story. I think then, you know, you go down a traditional route, you've got the support, right? You've got a lot of experience and support behind you. So you would be, you'd be guided to make the right decision. You're not going through the school of hard knocks. You're gonna be making decent decisions. And as well, like, cash flow is king. If you've got a fund supporting you and they've invested in you to get something, get a business and they believe in it, it's really their cash that's on the line. So they're not going to see you fail. They're going to be able to, they'll be able to cash flow you out of the problem.
True.
Which I think is, that's the comforting thing of the traditional search, right? You've got the experience and the money behind you to kind of see your way through the issues. Whereas if you go self-funded, you're just taking that on yourself. So, you know, if you run out of cash and you don't have the skills or aptitude to be able to solve the problems, yeah, that's on you.
That's interesting. So if you were to, you know, talk to the next cow who's out there to do his acquisition, what would you say to him? You know, what advice would you offer someone at the start of their acquisition journey?
I'd say don't get deal heat and don't get too carried away about having to get something. That's basically, I think, the situation that we've ended up in with this one. Otherwise, it's, yeah, try and, I think, like partnering, like this is such a great community. If you want to be the operator, I suppose there's investors out there. See if you can partner with someone that's done it before or get investment behind you. Depends on the size that you want. Like, I suppose my thesis was a little bit, so I didn't expect to kind of take any money out of this for 12 months or so. I just wanted to kind of go through the process and have a successful acquisition in under my belt. And then my thinking was that, okay, if I can prove that I've got the skill set to then rinse and repeat a model, then I can get investment much easier than if I haven't done anything and I'm trying to get convince people to back me just because I think buying a business is a good idea. I think, so I guess that the answer would be like, just know yourself, know what you're after and what you're trying to do. So yeah, mine was I can keep working and I can keep doing, I can consult on the side of doing the purchase. Me and my business partner would be able to solve all the problems. We'll get to the end of 12 months and we'll hopefully be in a position where we can go again, versus the other mentality probably is I need to earn an income. So I need financial support while I go through an acquisition. And then potentially want to be buying something a bit bigger or a lot bigger.
Something you can start drawing a salary from early on, and I suppose having it's a double-edged sword, I suppose, because it seems to take up more of your time, I guess, but there is less pressure on it to take some cash out, and you did have a bit of space for learning. So it's a super interesting route. And, you know, as for, you know, the business that you did acquire, how did you go about finding, selecting, you know, talking to that target? Was it an off-market search? Did you find it through a broker?
This one's through a broker. This one's through KBS, who are generally rubbish. But, yeah. probably shouldn't say that. But I was doing letters. So I was getting database off I was using a market research company.
Okay.
I think they're called Market Location. So I was using their database. I had a template letter and I was sending 500 letters a month for a long period of time, like 6 months plus, 6 months.
Okay.
That was one method. Other one was I used a LinkedIn consultant to like message or connect. Like basically they jump on my profile, connect with people and then set up calls for me. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, brokers. I was registered with every broker I could register with and was trying to find people I could just speak to regularly and keep sending me stuff.
That's interesting. And were all those tactics specifically in health, or was this for the construction deals beforehand and then you moved into health later?
That was the construction. That was a construction route. The health one was really quick. I think started searching. I'm pretty sure from start search to then buying this was like 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
Met with like 3 or 4, and then it was just fast. Yeah, it was way faster.
And part of that, do you think, was maybe, as you described it, deal heat? You were so sort of itching to get a deal done, it maybe moved along a little bit quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, from agreeing a deal to then completing on this first one was just over 2 months. And that was definitely just pushing everything through to do it as fast as possible.
Wow, that is quick. But, you know, like you said, you gave yourself space to learn. There wasn't a huge risk to you. And you've now got that playbook. And like you said, you can go and apply that elsewhere. And you spoke a little bit about your plans, but, you know, what is next for you with this playbook? Is it going to an investor and saying, hey, I've done this before, I've learned all the lessons, let's go in and buy a, you know, slightly larger practice or collection thereof? Or, you know, are there some other routes that you're looking at taking to expand?
Yeah, there's all of the above, I suppose. There's so I've got a good size practice lined up now to acquire, which is also in South London. And that one, the gentleman, he wants, you know, he's adamant for some cash on the table on completion. So that one needs investor funding. I don't have the money for it and don't want to do it all on debt. And he doesn't want it to be all done on debt as well.
Sure.
So that was while I was at the last networking event. But the thing is, it's basically you need to be raising over $1 million from these funds or I suppose like family offices and things like that to actually get your foot in the door. So this one, I'd only need 700. So I'm not quite there. So I think, I'm looking at other kind of alternatives now. So I'm thinking about the consulting for equity route where I can basically start off coming in as an advisor, fix problems, help people get sale ready. I've got my playbook that I can present to them. And then they can pick bits that they like off that and tell me bits that they don't want help with. Start off with a consulting fee and then moving to, well, a small consulting fee with a bit of equity. But the main thing that you want to get out of that is like an option to buy, right? So that to me sounds like the perfect route to kind of build up a group, because you can get some cash flow off the bat. You're not reliant on the business. You're agreeing with someone and building a relationship with someone who's going to sell you their business. Mm-hmm. As long as you've got an option in place, you can stitch up a few of those together and then go to a fund or whatever and be like, look, I'm ready to go. I've got 6, 7, however many places, got the option to buy, just need your money to execute. I know how they run. I've been consulting there for however long. You know, you've got a good in and a good story to tell. Plus you've got your playbook in your back pocket to then continue fixing problems if they're there or for the funder to see if they're not sure about your credentials or what you're planning to do.
Well, and hopefully if they've been working with you, they've been implementing some of your playbooks. So it's not like coming in on day one and having to tear everything up and start again. It's already working in the way that you would like it to, and you can sort of hit the ground running.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And any goals for you as an owner and operator, any sort of personal growth goals as a sort of entrepreneur and business leader? What are you hoping to achieve in the next couple of years?
I don't know. That's a good one.
Nothing in particular. I don't know. I think I like this, the consulting for equity type play, I think is quite nice. I mean, I'd like to just be through this journey that help people have a succession planning and kind of remove themselves from the business. I think it's like the guy we bought from was like stressed out of his mind. He like, his business was failing. Like he was not in a good place. He was working nonstop. He was starting to get health issues. I think like your emotions kind of like weigh your body down, don't they? So
yeah,
he was just starting to fall apart and he was so frazzled. Since taking it over, he's had much more time and is just a happier person. I think that's kind of potentially people to look at, as well as this gentleman that I've told you about who's ready to sell his clinic in South London.
Yeah.
He's just no succession plan. He's been trying to sell it for 2 years. Great difficulty. People can't raise the money for it. Maybe he wants too much. Who knows? But if I can go in there and convince him to sell to me, we can have some sort of consulting arrangement to kick off a purchase agreement. And he can see the way I operate. Then hopefully that's kind of like an easier sell, right? An easier in. And just helping people like this, you know, that have these clinics that they're kind of struggling. And I help take some weight off them, help them enjoy their life a bit better. Doesn't have to be for an acquisition up all outright, but just take some services away from them to make their clinic and life easier.
I think that's a really nice sort of positive side effect is, yeah, you do have that impact on business owners and operators' lives. I mean, something that we see quite often is that people go into business because they're good at what they do, not necessarily because they like running a business. So, you know, they might have been, you know, a great physio or construction. It's super common as well. And then they get to this point in time where they are kind of ground down by the day-to-day of it. They don't get to do the bit of it that they love anymore. There's a whole lot of other pressures. And if someone like you can come in and alleviate some of that, then that must be a great feeling for them and a great feeling for you. And hopefully, you know, leads to plenty more acquisitions along the way for you.
Let's see. I hope so. Right.
Awesome. Well, Cal, thank you very much for joining us. It's been super illuminating. I'm sure our listeners will feel the same. If anybody is in this kind of space and wants to connect with Cal, we will leave his LinkedIn details on the bottom of this video. So, you know, if you are the owner of a physiotherapist practice and you need someone to come and do some consulting, or you're in the same space, you want to network, or you want to give him 700K to buy a practice in South London, then please do get in touch with him. We can always make introductions through the BizConscious platform as well. So, Cal, thank you very much for joining us.
Perfect. Thanks, Alfie. Thanks for having me. Good talking to you.
And that's it for the M&A Zing. We will see you next week.